Carol Danner smiled, and the smile changed her pretty face into one that was beautiful. "I think that's very sweet," she said. "If you'd like to browse for 10 or 15 minutes, I'll have the card made up for you when you come back to the desk." Ben grinned a little. "I guess there'll be a fee," he said, "out of toner and all." "Did you have a card when you were a boy?" "I sure did," Ben smiled. "Except for my friends, I guess that library card was the most important." "Ben, would you come up here?" A voice called suddenly, cutting across the library hush like a scalpel. He turned around, jumping guiltily the way people do when someone shouts in the library. He saw no one he knew, and realized a moment later that no one had looked up or shown any sign of surprise or annoyance. The old men still read their copies of the Derry News, the Boston Globe, National Geographic, Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report. At the tables in the reference room, two high school girls still had their heads together over a stack of papers and a pile of file cards. Several browsers went on looking through the books on the shelves marked Current Fiction, 7-Day Loan. An old man in a ridiculous driving cap, a cold pipe clenched between his teeth, went on leafing through a folio of Luis de Vargas sketches. He turned back to the young woman who was looking at him, puzzled. "Is anything wrong?" "No," Ben said, smiling. "I thought I heard something. I guess I'm more jet-lagged than I thought. What were you saying?" "Well, actually, you were saying. But I was about to add that if you had a card when you were a resident, your name will still be in the files," she said. "We keep everything on microfiche now. Some change from when you were a kid here, I guess." "Yes," he said. "A lot of things have changed in Derry, but a lot of things also seem to have remained the same. Anyway, I can just look you up and give you a renewal card, no charge." "That's great," Ben said. And before he could add thanks, the voice cut through the library's sacramental silence again, louder now, ominously jolly.
"Come on up, Ben. Come on up, you fat little fuck. This is your life, Ben Hanscom."
Ben cleared his throat. "I appreciate it," he said. "Don't mention it," she cocked her head at him. "Has it gotten warm outside?"
"A little," he said.
"Why?"
"You're..." "Ben Hanscom did it," the voice screamed. It was coming from above, coming from the stacks. "Ben Hanscom killed the children. Get him, grab him."
"Perspiring," she finished.
"Am I?" he said idiotically.
"I'll have this made up right away," she said.
"Thank you."
She headed for the old Royal typewriter at the corner of her desk. Ben walked slowly away, his heart a thudding drum in his chest. Yes, he was sweating. He could feel it trickling down from his forehead, his armpits matting the hair on his chest. He looked up and saw Pennywise the Clown standing at the top of the left-hand staircase, looking down at him. His face was white with grease paint. His mouth bled lipstick in a killer's grin. There were empty sockets where his eyes should have been. He held a bunch of balloons in one hand and a book in the other.
"Not he," Ben thought. "It.
I am standing here in the middle of the Derry Public Library's rotunda on a late spring afternoon in 1985. I am a grown man, and I am face to face with my childhood's greatest nightmare. I am face to face with it."
"Come on up, Ben," Pennywise called down. "I won't hurt you. I've got a book for you. A book and a balloon. Come on up."
Ben opened his mouth to call back, "You're insane if you think I'm going up there," and suddenly realized that if he did that, everyone here would be looking at him. Everyone here would be thinking, "Who is that crazy man?"
"Oh, I know you can't answer," Pennywise called down and giggled. "Almost fooled you there for a minute, though, didn't I? Pardon me, sir, do you have Prince Albert in a can?" "You do? Better let the poor guy out." "Pardon me, ma'am, is your refrigerator running?" "It is." "Then hadn't you better go catch it?"
The clown on the landing threw its head back and shrieked laughter. It roared and echoed in the dome of the rotunda like a flight of black bats, and Ben was only able to keep from clapping his hands over his ears with a tremendous effort of will.
"Come on up, Ben," Pennywise called down. "We'll talk. Neutral ground. What do you say?"
"I'm not coming up there," Ben thought. "When I finally come to you, you won't want to see me, I think. We're going to kill you." The clown shrieked laughter again.
"Kill me? Kill me?"
And suddenly, horribly, the voice was Richie Tozier's voice. Not his voice, precisely, but Richie Tozier doing his pickaninny voice.
"Don't kill me, massa. I be a good nigger. Don't kill this yer black boy, haystack."
Then that shrieking laughter again. trembling, white-faced, Ben walked across the echoing center of the adults' library. He felt that soon he would vomit. He stood in front of a shelf of books and took one down at random with a hand that trembled badly. His cold fingers flittered the pages.
"This is your one chance, Haystack,"
the voice called from behind and above him.
"Get out of town. Get out before it gets dark tonight. I'll be after you tonight, you and the others. You're too old to stop me, Ben. You're all too old. Too old to do anything but get yourselves killed. Get out, Ben. Do you want to see this tonight?"
He turned slowly, still holding the book in his icy hands. He didn't want to look, but it was as if there were an invisible hand under his chin, tilting his head up and up and up. The clown was gone. Dracula was standing at the top of the left-hand stairway. But it was no movie Dracula. It was not Bela Lugosi or Christopher Lee or Frank Langella or Francis Lederer or Reggie Nalder. An ancient man-thing with a face like a twisted root stood there. Its face was deadly pale, its eyes purplish-red, the color of blood clots. Its mouth dropped open, revealing a mouthful of Gillette Blue Blades that had been set in the gums at angles. It was like looking into a deadly mirror maze where a single misstep could get you cut in half.
"Key wrench!"
it screamed, and its jaws snapped closed. Blood gouted from its mouth in a red-black flood. Chunks of its severed lips fell to the glowing white silk of its formal shirt and slid down its front, leaving snail trails of blood behind.
"What did Stan Ura see before he died?"
The vampire on the landing screamed down at him, laughing through the bloody hole of its mouth.
"Was it Prince Albert in a can? Was it Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier? What did he see, Ben? Do you want to see it, too? What did he see? What did he see?"
Then that shrieking laughter again. And Ben knew that he would scream now himself, yes. There was no way to stop the scream. It was going to come. Blood was pattering down from the landing in a grisly shower. One drop had landed on the arthritis-bunched hand of an old man who was reading the Wall Street Journal. It was running down between his knuckles, unseen and unfelt. Ben hitched in breath, sure the scream would follow, unthinkable in the quiet of this softly drizzling spring afternoon, as shocking as the slash of a knife or a mouthful of razor blades. Instead, what came out in a shaky, uneven rush, spoken instead of screamed, spoken low like a prayer, were these words.
"We made slugs out of it, of course. We made the silver dollar into silver slugs."
The gentleman in the driving cap, who had been perusing the De Vargas sketches, looked up sharply.
"Nonsense,"
he said. Now people did look up. Someone hissed, "Shh," at the old man in an annoyed voice.
"I'm sorry,"
Ben said in a low, trembling voice. He was faintly aware that his face was now running with sweat and that his shirt was plastered to his body.
"I was thinking aloud."
"Nonsense,"
the old gentleman repeated in a louder voice.
"Can't make silver bullets from silver dollars. Common misconception. Pulp fiction. Problem is with specific gravity."
Suddenly the woman, Miss Danner, was there.
"Mr. Brockhill, you'll have to be quiet," she said kindly enough. "People are reading."
"Man's sick," Brockhill said abruptly and went back to his book. "Give him an aspirin, Carol."
Carol Danner looked at Ben and her face sharpened with concern.
"Are you ill, Mr. Hanscom? I know it's terribly impolite to say so, but you look terrible."
Ben said, I had Chinese food for lunch. I don't think it's agreed with me."
"If you want to lie down, there's a cot in Mr. Hanlon's office. You could..."
"No, thanks, but no." What he wanted was not to lie down, but to get the hell out of the Derry Public Library. He looked up at the landing. The clown was gone. The vampire was gone. But tied to the low wrought iron railing which surrounded the landing was a balloon. Written on its bulging skin were the words, "Have a good day. Tonight you die."
"I've got your library card," she said, putting a tentative hand on his arm. "Do you still want it?"
"Yes, thanks," Ben said. He drew a deep, shuddery breath.
"I'm very sorry about this."
"I just hope it isn't food poisoning," she said.
"Wouldn't work,"
Mr. Brockhill said, without looking up from De Vargas or removing his dead pipe from the corner of his mouth.
"Device of pulp fiction. Bullet would tumble."
And speaking again with no foreknowledge that he was going to speak, Ben said,
"Slugs, not bullets.
We realized almost right away that we couldn't make bullets. I mean, we were just kids. It was my idea to..."
"Shh,"
someone said again.
Rocchio gave Ben a slightly startled look, seemed about to speak, then went back to the sketches. At the desk, Carol Danner handed him a small orange card with Derry Public Library stamped across the top. Bemused, Ben realized it was the first adult library card he had owned in his whole life. The one he'd had as a kid had been canary yellow.
Are you sure you don't want to lie down, Mr. Hanscom?
I'm feeling a little better, thanks.
Sure?
He managed a smile. I'm sure.
You do look a little better, she said, but she said it doubtfully, as if understanding that this was the proper thing to say, but not really believing it.
Then she was holding a book under the microfilm gadget they use these days to record book loans, and Ben felt a touch of almost hysterical amusement.
It's the book I grabbed off the shelf when the clown started to do its pickaninny voice, he thought. She thought I wanted to borrow it. I've made my first withdrawal from the Derry Public Library in 25 years, and I don't even know what the book is. Furthermore, I don't care. Just let me out of here, okay? That'll be enough.
Thank you, he said, putting the book under his arm.
You're more than welcome, Mr. Hanscom. Are you sure you wouldn't like an aspirin?
Quite sure, he said, and then hesitated.
You wouldn't by any chance know what happened to Mrs. Sterrett, would you? Barbara Sterrett? She used to be the head of the children's library.
She died, Carol Danner said, 3 years ago. It was a stroke, I understand. It was a great shame. She was relatively young, 58 or 59, I think. Mr. Hanlon closed the library for the day.
Oh,
Ben said, and felt a hollow place open in his heart.
That's what happened when you got back to your used-to-be, as the song put it. The frosting on the cake was sweet, but the stuff underneath was bitter. People forgot you, or died on you, or lost their hair and teeth. In some cases, you found that they had lost their minds. Oh, it was great to be alive. Boy, howdy.
I'm sorry, she said. You liked her, didn't you?
All the kids liked Mrs. Sterrett, Ben said, and was alarmed to realize that tears were now very close.
Are you?
If she asks me if I'm all right one more time, I really am going to cry, I think, or scream, or something.
He glanced at his watch and said, I really have to run. Thanks for being so nice.
Have a nice day, Mr. Hanscom.
Sure, because tonight I die.
He tipped a finger her way and started back across the floor. Mr. Brocchio glanced up at him once, sharply and suspiciously. He looked up at the landing, which topped the left-hand staircase. The balloon still floated there, tied by its string to lacy wrought iron, but now the printing on its side read, I killed Barbara Sterrett. Pennywise the Clown. He looked away, feeling the pulse in his throat starting to run again. He let himself out and was startled by sunlight. The clouds overhead were coming unraveled, and the warm late May sun was shafting down, making the grass look impossibly green and lush. Ben felt something start to lift from his heart. It seemed to him that he had left some insupportable burden behind in the library. And then he looked down at the book he had inadvertently withdrawn, and his teeth clamped together with sudden painful force. It was Bulldozer by Stephen W. Meader, one of the books he had withdrawn from the library on the day he had dived into the Barrens to get away from Henry Bowers and his friends. And speaking of Henry, the track of his engineer boot was still on the book's cover. Shaking, fumbling at the pages, he turned to the back. The library had gone over to a microfilm checkout system. He had seen that. But there was still a pocket in the back of this book with a card tucked into it. There was a name written on each line of the card, followed by the librarian's return date stamp. Looking at the card, Ben saw this. Name of borrower, Charles N. Brown. Return by stamped date, May 14th, 58. Name of borrower, David Hartwell. Return by stamped date, June 1st, 58. Name of borrower, Joseph Brennan. Return by stamped date, June 17th, 58. And on the last line of the card, his own childish signature, written in heavy pencil strokes. Benjamin Hanscom, July 9th, 58. Stamped across this card, stamped across the book's flyleaf, stamped across the thickness of the pages, stamped again and again in a smeary red ink that looked like blood, was one word. Cancel.
Oh, dear God,
Ben murmured. He did not know what else to say. That seemed to cover the entire situation.
Oh, dear God, dear God.
He stood in the new sunlight, suddenly wondering what was happening to the others. 2. Eddie Kasprak makes a catch. Eddie got off the bus at the corner of Kansas Street and Kossuth Lane. Kossuth was a street that ran a quarter of a mile downhill before dead-ending abruptly where the crumbling earth sloped into the barrens. He had absolutely no idea why he had chosen this place to leave the bus. Kossuth Lane meant nothing to him, and he had known no one on this particular section of Kansas Street. But it seemed like the right place. That was all he knew. But at this point, it seemed to be enough. Beverly had climbed off the bus with a little wave at one of the lower Main Street stops. Mike had taken his car back to the library. Now, watching the small and somehow absurd Mercedes bus pull away, he wondered exactly what he was doing here, standing on an obscure street corner in an obscure town nearly 500 miles away from Myra, who was undoubtedly worried to tears about him. He felt an instant of almost painful vertigo, touched his jacket pocket, and remembered that he had left his Dramamine back at the townhouse along with the rest of his pharmacopoeia. He had aspirin, though. He would no more have gone out sans aspirin than he would have gone out sans pants. He chugged a couple dry and began to walk along Kansas Street, thinking vaguely that he might go to the public library or perhaps cross over to Costello Avenue. It was beginning to clear now, and he supposed he could even walk across to West Broadway and admire the old Victorian houses that stood there, along with the only two really handsome residential blocks in Derry. He used to do that sometimes when he was a kid, just walk along West Broadway, sort of casual, like he was on his way to somewhere else. There was the Mueller's near the corner of Wycham and West Broadway, a red house with turrets on either side and hedges in front. The Mueller's had a gardener who always looked at Eddie with suspicious eyes until he had passed on his way. Then there was the Bowie's house, which was four down from the Mueller's on the same side. One of the reasons he supposed that Greta Bowie and Sally Mueller had been such great friends in grammar school. It was green-shingled and also had turrets, but while the turrets on the Mueller's house were squared off, those on the Bowie's house were capped with funny cone-shaped things that looked to Eddie like squatty dunce caps. In the summer, there was always lawn furniture on the side lawn, a table with a sporty yellow umbrella over it, wicker chairs, a rope hammock stretched between two trees. There was always a croquet game set up out back, too. Eddie knew this, although he had never been invited over to Greta's house to play croquet. Walking by casually, like he was on his way to somewhere else, Eddie would sometimes hear the click of the balls, laughter, groans as someone's ball was sent away. Once he had seen Greta herself, a lemonade in one hand and her croquet mallet in the other, looking slim and pretty beyond the words of all the poets. Even her sunburned shoulders seemed wonderfully pretty to Eddie Kasprak, who had at that time been nine. Going after her ball, which had been sent away. It had ricocheted off a tree and had thus brought Greta into Eddie's view. He fell in love with her a little that day, her shining blonde hair falling to the shoulders of her culotte dress, which was a cool blue. She glanced around, and for a moment he thought she had seen him, but that proved not to be so, because when he raised his hand in a timid hello, she did not raise hers in return, but only whacked her ball back onto the rear lawn and then ran after it. He had walked on with no resentment at the unreturned hello. He genuinely believed she must not have seen him, or at the fact that he had never been invited to attend one of the Saturday afternoon croquet games. Why would a beautiful girl like Greta Bowie want to invite a kid like him? He was thin-chested, asthmatic, and had the face of a drowned water rat. Yeah, he thought, walking aimlessly back down Kansas Street. I should have gone over to West Broadway and looked at all those houses again. The Mueller's, the Bowie's, Dr. Hale's place, the Tracker's. His thoughts broke off abruptly at that last name because, speak of the devil, here he was, standing in front of Tracker Brothers Truck Depot. Still right here, Eddie said aloud and laughed. Son of a gun. The house on West Broadway, which belonged to Phil and Tony Tracker, a pair of lifelong bachelors, was probably the loveliest of the large houses on that street, a spotlessly white mid-Victorian with green lawns and great beds of flowers that rioted, in a neatly landscaped way, of course, all the spring and summer long. Their driveway was freshly sealed each fall so that it always remained as black as a dark mirror. The slate shingles on the many slants of the roof were always a perfect mint green that almost exactly matched the lawn, and people sometimes stopped to take pictures of the mullioned windows, which were very old and quite remarkable. Any two men who bother keeping a house so nice must be queers, Eddie's mother had once said in a disgruntled sort of way, and Eddie hadn't dared ask for clarification. The truck depot was the exact opposite of the Tracker House on West Broadway. It was a low brick structure. The bricks were old and crumbling in places, their dirty orange hue shading to a sooty black at the building's footings. The windows were uniformly filthy except for a small circular place on one of the lower panes of the starter's office. This one pane had been kept spotlessly clean by kids before Eddie and those who came after, because the starter kept a Playboy calendar over his desk. No boy came to play scratch baseball in the back lot without first stopping to wipe at the glass with his ball glove and examine that month's pinup. The depot was surrounded by a waste of gravel on three sides. Long-distance haulers, Jimmy Peets and Kenworths and Rios, all painted with the words Tracker Brothers. Derry, Newton, Providence, Hartford, New York, sometimes stood here in tangled, disordered profusion. Sometimes they were put together and sometimes they were just cabs or body boxes, standing silent on their rear wheels and support struts. The brothers kept their trucks out of the lot at the back of the building as much as they could because they were both avid baseball fans and liked the kids to come and play. Phil Tracker drove freight himself, so the boys rarely saw him, but Tony Tracker, a man with huge slab arms and a gut to match, kept the books and the accounts, and Eddie, who never played, his mother would have killed him if she had heard he was playing baseball, racing around and getting dust in his delicate lungs, risking broken legs, concussions, and God alone knew what else, got used to seeing him. He was a summer fixture, his voice as much a part of the game to Eddie then as Mel Allen's later became. Tony Tracker, large but somehow ghost-like, his white shirt glimmering as summer dusk drew down and fireflies began to loom the air with their lace of lights, yelling, "You've got to get under that ball before you can catch it, Red. You took your eye off in the ball, half-plank. You can't hit the goddamn thing if you ain't looking at it. Slide, horsefoot. You get the soles of them kids in that second baseman's face, he ain't never gonna tag you out." Never called any of them by name, Eddie remembered. It was always, "Hey, Red, hey, Blondie, hey, Four Eyes, hey, half-plank." It was never a ball, it was always a ball. It was never a bat. It was always something Tony Tracker called an ash handle, as in, "You ain't never going to hit that ball if you don't choke up on the ash handle, horsefoot." Grinning, Eddie walked a little closer. And then the grin faded. The long brick building where orders had been processed, trucks repaired, and goods stored on a short-term basis was now dark and silent. Weeds were growing up through the gravel, and there were no trucks in either side yard. Only a single box, its sides rusty and dull. Getting closer still, he saw that there was a Realtor's for sale sign in the window. Tracker's out of business, he thought, and was surprised at the sadness the thought carried with it, as if someone had died. He was glad now he hadn't walked over to West Broadway. If Tracker Brothers could have gone under, Tracker Brothers, which had seemed eternal, what might have happened on that street he had liked so much to walk down as a kid? He realized uneasily that he didn't want to know. He didn't want to see Greta Bowie with gray in her hair, her hips and legs thickened with much sitting and much eating and much drinking. It was better, safer, to just stay away. That's what we all should have done, just stayed away. We've got no business here. Coming back to where you grew up is like doing some crazy yoga trick, putting your feet in your own mouth and somehow swallowing yourself so there's nothing left. It can't be done, and any sane person ought to be fucking glad it can't. What do you suppose happened to Tony and Phil Tracker anyway? A heart attack for Tony, perhaps. He had been carrying maybe 75 extra pounds of meat on his bones. You had to watch out for what your heart might be up to. The poets might romance about broken hearts and Barry Manilow sing about them, and that was fine by Eddie. He and Myra had every album Barry Manilow had ever recorded, but he himself preferred a good solid EKG every year. Sure, Tony's heart had probably given it up as a bad job. And Phil? Bad luck on the highway, maybe. Eddie, who made his living behind the wheel himself, or had, these days he only drove the celebs and spent the rest of his time driving a desk, knew about bad luck on the highway. Old Phil might have jackknifed a rig somewhere in New Hampshire or in the Haynesville woods up north in Maine when the going was icy, or maybe he had lost his brakes on some long hill south of Derry, heading into Haven in a driving springtime rain. Those things, or any of the others you heard in those shit-kicking country songs about truck drivers who wore Stetson hats and had cheating on their minds. Driving a desk was sometimes lonely, but Eddie had been in the driver's seat himself more than once, his aspirator riding there with him on the dashboard, its trigger reflected ghostly in the windshield, and a bucket load of pills in the glove compartment. And he knew that real loneliness was a smeary red, the color of the taillights of the car ahead of you reflected on wet hot top in a driving rain.
"Oh, shit, the time goes by," Eddie Kasprak said in a sighing sort of whisper, and was not even aware that he had spoken aloud.
Feeling both mellow and unhappy, a state more common to him than he ever would have believed, Eddie skirted the building, Gucci loafers crunching in the gravel, to look at the lot where the baseball games had been played when he was a kid, when it seemed 90% of the world had been made up of kids. The lot wasn't much changed, but a look was enough to convince him beyond doubt that the games had stopped, a tradition that had simply died out at some point in the years between for reasons of its own. In 1958, the diamond shape of the infield had been defined not by limed base paths, but in ruts made by running feet. They had no actual bases, those boys who had played baseball here, boys who were all older than the losers, although Eddie remembered now that Stan Urys had sometimes played. His batting was only fair, but in the outfield he could run fast and he had the reflexes of an angel. But four pieces of dirty canvas were always kept under the loading bay behind the long brick building to be ceremonially taken out when enough kids had drifted into the back lot to play ball, and just as ceremonially returned when the shades of evening had fallen thickly enough to end further play. Standing here now, Eddie could see no trace of those rutted base paths. Weeds had grown up through the gravel in patchy profusion. Broken soda and beer bottles twinkled here and there. In the old days, such shards of broken glass had been religiously removed. The only thing that was the same was the chain-link fence at the back of the lot, 12 feet high and as rusty as dried blood. It framed the sky in droves of diamond shapes. That was home run territory, Eddie thought, standing bemused with his hands in his pockets at the place where home plate had been 27 years ago. Over the fence and down into the barrens, they used to call it the automatic. He laughed out loud and then looked around nervously, as if it were a ghost who had laughed out loud instead of a guy in $60 slacks. A guy as solid as, well, as solid as...
Get off it, Heads, Richie's voice seemed to whisper. You ain't solid at all. And in the last few years, the chucks have been few and far between, right?
Yeah, right,
Eddie said in a low voice, and kicked a few loose stones away in a rattle. In truth, he had only seen two balls go over the fence at the back of the lot behind Tracker Brothers, both of them hit by the same kid, Belch Huggins. Belch had been almost comically big, already 6 feet tall at 12, weighing maybe 170. He had gotten his nickname because he was able to articulate belches of amazing length and loudness. At his best, he sounded like a cross between a bullfrog and a cicada. Sometimes he would pat a hand rapidly across his open mouth while belching, emitting a sound like a horse Indian. Belch had been big and not really fat, Eddie remembered now, but it was as if God had never really intended for a boy of 12 to attain such remarkable size. If he had not died that summer, he might have grown to 6'6 or better, and might have learned along the way how to maneuver his outsized body through a world of smaller denizens. He might even, Eddie thought, have learned gentleness. But at 12, he had been both clumsy and mean, not retarded, but almost seeming so because all his body's actions seemed so amazingly graceless and lunging. He had none of Stanley's built-in rhythms. It was as if Belch's body did not talk to his brain at all, but existed in its own cosmos of slow thunder. Eddie could remember the evening a long, slow fly ball had been hit directly to Belch's position in the outfield. Belch didn't even have to move. He stood looking up, raised his glove in an almost aimless punching gesture, and instead of settling into his glove, the ball had struck him squarely on top of the head, producing a hollow bonk sound. It was as if the ball had been dropped from three stories up onto the roof of a Ford sedan. It bounced up a good 4 feet and came down neatly into Belch's glove. An unfortunate kid named Owen Phillips had laughed at that bonking sound. Belch had walked over to him and had kicked his ass so hard that the Phillips kid had run screaming for home with a hole in the seat of his pants. No one else laughed, at least not on the outside. Eddie supposed that if Richie Tozier had been there, he wouldn't have been able to help it, and Belch probably would have put him in the hospital. Belch was similarly slow at the plate.
He was easy to strike out, and if he hit a grounder, even the most fumble-fingered infielders had no trouble throwing him out at first. But when he got all of one, it went a long, long way. The two balls that he had seen Belch hit over the fence had both been wonders. The first had never been recovered, although more than a dozen boys had tramped back and forth over the steeply slanting slope which plunged down into the barrens looking for it. The second, however, had been recovered. The ball belonged to another sixth grader. Eddie could not now remember what his real name had been, only that all the other kids called him Snuffy because he always had a cold, and had been in use for most of the late spring and early summer of 58. As a result, it was no longer the nearly perfect spherical creation of white horsehide and red stitching that it had been when it came out of the box. It was scuffed, grass-stained, and cut in several places by its hundreds of bouncing trips over the gravel in the outfield. Its stitching was beginning to come unraveled in one place, and Eddie, who shagged foul balls when his asthma wasn't too bad, relishing every casual, "Thanks, kid," when he threw the ball back to the playing field, knew that soon someone would produce a roll of black cat friction tape and embalm it so they could get another week or so out of it. But before that day came, a seventh grader with the unlikely name of Stringer Dedham tossed what he fancied a change of speed pitch to Belch Huggins. Belch timed the pitch perfectly. The slow ones were, you should pardon the pun, just his speed, and hit Snuffy's elderly Spaulding so hard that the cover came right off and fluttered down just a few feet shy of second base like a big white moth. The ball itself had continued up and up into a gorgeous twilight sky, unraveling and unraveling as it went. Kids turning to follow its progress in dumb wonder. Up and over the chain-link fence it went, still rising. And Eddie remembered Stringer Dedham had said, "Holy shit," in a soft and awestruck voice as it went, riding a track into the sky. And they had all seen the unwinding string, and maybe even before it hit, six boys had been monkeying up that fence, and Eddie could remember Tony Tracker laughing in an amazed loon-like way and crying, "That one would have been out of Yankee Stadium. Do you hear me? That one would have been out of fucking Yankee Stadium." It had been Peter Gordon who found the ball, not far from the stream the Losers Club would dam up less than 3 weeks later. What was left was not even 3 inches through the center. It was some kind of cockeyed miracle that the twine had never broken. By unspoken consent, the boys had brought the remains of Snuffy's ball back to Tony Tracker, who examined it without saying a word, surrounded by boys who were likewise silent. Seen from a distance, that circle of boys standing around the tall man with the big sloping belly might have seemed almost religious in its intent, the veneration of a holy object. Belch Huggins had not even run around the bases. He only stood among the others like a boy who had no precise idea of where he was. What Tony Tracker handed him that day was smaller than a tennis ball. Eddie, lost in these memories, walked from the place where home had been, across the pitcher's mound. Only it had never been a mound. It had been a depression from which the gravel had been scraped clean, and out into shortstop country. He paused briefly, struck by the silence, and then strolled on out to the chain-link fence. It was rustier than ever, and overgrown by some sort of ugly climbing vine, but still there. Looking through it, he could see how the ground sloped away, aggressively green. The barrens were more jungle-like than ever, and for the first time he found himself wondering why a stretch of such tangled and virulent growth should have been called the barrens at all. It was many things, but barren was not one of them. Why not the wilderness, or the jungle? Barrens. It had an ominous, almost sinister sound, but what it conjured up in the mind were not tangles of shrubs and trees so thick they had to fight for sun space. It called up pictures of sand dunes shifting away endlessly, or gray slate expanses of hardpan and desert. Barren. Mike had said earlier that they were all barren, and it seemed true enough. Seven of them, and not a kid among them. Even in these days of Planned Parenthood, that was bucking the odds. He looked through the rusty diamond shapes, hearing the faraway drone of cars on Kansas Street, the faraway trickle and rush of water down below. He could see glints of it in the spring sunshine, like flashes of glass. The bamboo stands were still down there, looking unhealthily white, like patches of fungus in all the green. Beyond them, in the marshy stretches of ground bordering the Kanduskeag, there was supposed to have been quick mud. "I spent the happiest times of my childhood down there in that mess," he thought, and shivered. He was about to turn away when something else caught his eye.
a cement cylinder with a heavy steel cap on the top. Morlock holes, Ben used to call them, laughing with his mouth, but not quite laughing with his eyes. If you went over to one, it would stand maybe waist high on you, if you were a kid. And you would see the words, Derry Department of Public Works, stamped in raised metal in a semicircle. And you could hear a humming noise from deep inside. Some sort of machinery. Morlock holes. That's where we went. In August, in the end. We went into one of Ben's Morlock holes, into the sewers. But after a while, they weren't sewers anymore. They were what? Patrick Hochstetter was down there. Before it took him, Beverly saw him doing something bad. It made her laugh, but she knew it was bad. Something to do with Henry Bowers, wasn't it? Yes, I think so, and... He turned away suddenly and started back toward the abandoned depot, not wanting to look down into the barrens anymore, not liking the thoughts they conjured up. He wanted to be home with Myra. He didn't want to be here. He... Catch, kid! He turned toward the sound of the voice, and here came some sort of a ball right over the fence and toward him. It struck the gravel and bounced. Eddie stuck out his hand and caught it. In his unthinking reflex, the catch was so neat it was almost elegant. He looked down at what was in his hand, and everything inside him went cool and loose. Once it had been a baseball. Now it was only a string-wrapped sphere, because the cover had been knocked off. He could see the string trailing away. It went over the top of the fence like a strand of spider web and disappeared into the barrens. Oh, Jesus, he thought. Oh, Jesus, it's here. It's here with me. Now. Come on down and play, Eddie, the voice on the other side of the fence said. And Eddie realized with a fainting sort of horror that it was the voice of Belch Huggins, who had been murdered in the tunnels under Derry in August of 1958. And now here was the Belch himself, struggling up and over the bank on the other side of the fence. He wore a pinstriped New York Yankees baseball uniform that was flecked with bits of autumn leaves and smeared with green. He was Belch, but he was also the leper, a creature hideously arisen from long years in a wet grave. The flesh of his heavy face hung in putrescent strings and runners. One eye socket was empty. Things squirmed in his hair. He wore a moss-slimed baseball glove on one hand. He poked the rotting fingers of his right hand through the diamonds of the chain-link fence, and when he curled them, Eddie heard a dreadful squirting sound which he thought might drive him mad.
That one would have been out of Yankee Stadium, Belch said and grinned.
A toad, noxiously white and squirming, dropped from his mouth and tumbled to the ground.
Do you hear me? That one would have been out of fucking Yankee Stadium. And by the way, Eddie, if you want a blowjob, I'll do it for a dime. Hell, I'll do it for free.
Belch's face changed. The jelly-like bulb of nose fell in, revealing two raw red channels that Eddie had seen in his dreams. His hair coarsened and drew back from his temples, turned cobweb white. The rotting skin on his forehead split open, revealing white bone covered with a mucousy substance like the bleared lens of a searchlight. Belch was gone. The thing which had been under the porch at 29 Niebold Street was here now.
Bobby blows me for a dime, it crooned, beginning to climb the fence.
It left little pieces of its flesh in the diamond shapes the crisscrossing wires made. The fence jingled and rattled with its weight. When it touched the climbing vine-like weeds, they turned black.
He will do it any time. 15 cents for overtime.
Eddie tried to scream. Nothing but a dry, senseless squeak came out of him. His lungs felt like the world's oldest ocarinas. He looked down at the ball in his hand, and suddenly blood began to sweat up from between the wrapped strings. It pattered to the gravel and splashed on his loafers. He threw it down and took two lurching stagger steps backward, his eyes bulging from his face, rubbing his hands on the front of his shirt. The leper had reached the top of the fence. Its head swayed in silhouette against the sky, a nightmare shaped like a bloated Halloween jack-o'-lantern. Its tongue lolled out, 4 feet long, perhaps six. It twined its way down the fence like a snake from the leper's grinning mouth. There 1 second, gone the next. It did not fade like a ghost in a movie. It simply winked out of existence. But Eddie heard a sound which confirmed its essential solidity. A pop sound, like a cork blowing out of a champagne bottle. It was the sound of air rushing in to fill the place where the leper had been. He turned and began to run, but before he had gone 10 feet, four stiff shapes flew out from the shadows under the loading bay of the abandoned brick depot. He thought at first they were bats, and he screamed and covered his head. Then he saw that they were squares of canvas, the squares of canvas that had been the bases when the big kids played here. They whirled and twirled in the still air. He had to duck to avoid one of them. They settled in their accustomed places all at once, kicking up little puffs of grit. Home, first, second, third. Gasping, his breath short in his throat, Eddie ran past home plate, his lips drawn back, his face as white as cottage cheese. Whack! The sound of a bat hitting a phantom ball. And then Eddie stopped, the strength going out of his legs, a groan passing his lips. The ground was bulging in a straight line from home to first, as if a gigantic gopher was tunneling rapidly just below the surface of the ground. Gravel rolled off to either side. The shape under the earth reached the base, and the canvas flipped up into the air. It went up so hard and fast it made a popping sound, the sound a shoeshine kid makes when he's feeling good and pops the rag. The ground began to ridge between first and second, racing and racing. Second base flew into the air with a similar popping sound and had barely settled back before the shape under the ground had reached third and was racing for home. Home plate flew up as well. But before it could come down, the thing had popped out of the ground like some grisly party favor. And the thing was Tony Tracker, his face a skull to which a few blackened chunks of flesh still clung, his white shirt a mess of rotted linen strings. He poked out of the earth at home plate from the waist up, swaying back and forth like a grotesque worm.
"Don't matter how much you choke up on that ash handle," Tony Tracker said in a gritty, grinding voice. Exposed teeth grinned in lunatic chumminess. "Don't matter, Wheezy. We'll get you. We and your friends. We'll have a ball."
Eddie shrieked and staggered away. There was a hand on his shoulder. He shrank away from it. The hand tightened for a moment, then gave way. He turned. It was Greta Bowie. She was dead. Half of her face was gone. Maggots crawled in the churned red meat that was left. She held a green balloon in one hand.
"Car crash,"
the recognizable half of her mouth said and grinned. The grin caused an unspeakable ripping sound, and Eddie could see raw tendons moving like terrible straps.
"I was 18, Eddie, drunk and done up on reds. Your friends are here, Eddie."
Eddie backed away from her, his hands held up in front of his face. She walked toward him. Blood had splashed, then dried on her legs in long splotches. She was wearing penny loafers. And now beyond her, he saw the ultimate horror. Patrick Hockstetter was shambling toward him across the outfield. He, too, was wearing a New York Yankees uniform. Eddie ran. Greta clutched at him again, tearing his shirt and spilling some terrible liquid down the back of his collar. Tony Tracker was pulling himself out of his man-sized gopher run. Patrick Hockstetter stumbled and staggered. Eddie ran, not knowing where he was finding the breath to run, but running somehow anyway. And as he ran, he saw words floating in front of him, the words that had been printed on the side of the green balloon Greta Bowie had been holding.